Hello, this is Robert Rickover at Body Learning, and today my guest is Peter Grunewald, who's an Alexander Technique teacher who lives in Auckland, New Zealand. He's been a teacher for about 25 years, and for the last 20 years or so, he has been exploring the connections between the Alexander Technique and vision re-education. He's become quite well known in the Alexander world for his workshops on vision and the technique. And we've had one conversation where we've talked sort of generally about what he does on those workshops, how some of his early discoveries about vision and the technique. And we're going to have a follow-up conversation where we're going to maybe cover a number of different areas, perhaps going a little deeper into some of his discoveries, and it's going to be a bit of an experimental conversation, but we're going to give it a shot. Peter, welcome to the show.
Hi, Robert. Wonderful to be back here again.
Good to have you back. So, Peter, just before we get into the meat of what we're going to talk about, for our listeners who are not familiar with the Alexander technique, could you give us a short description of the technique?
Yes, Alexander was, I think, really a genius. He discovered how to undo unnecessary habits which were really ruling his, let's say, his brain and his body motions. And he was really able, with mental inhibitions and directions, to overcome his speech and his physiology in a way which does not really support his day-to-day living.
Right.
That might be one answer, and one can have many different answers.
Sure.
How to explain the Alexander technique.
And when we talk about inhibition, it's really important, I think, to make it clear to our listeners that this has nothing to do with Freudian inhibition.
Exactly.
It's an unfortunate accident of history. Actually, Alexander came first with the phrase, but yes, Freud became more famous. And Alexander inhibition just means saying no to something you don't want, but it has nothing to do with repression or that sort of thing. So in our earlier conversation, you described some of your early experiences and discoveries of connections between aspects of the eye, the cornea, the retina, and so on, with parts of the rest of our body, and how you ultimately found a kind of I don't know if this is the right way to describe it, but a kind of a controlling mechanism in the back of our heads, basically back of our brains, that really directs both vision and everything else, kind of a super directing area, I guess you could say. And after we finished our conversation, you said, but there are some other things that we could talk about as well related to this. So I'm going to give it over to you right now to lead us in those directions.
Good. Thank you very much, Robert. I guess I've got a chart here in front of my eyes, and I just like to take the listeners on a tiny little journey, almost like inside our brain. Because if we talk about vision, we talk about light waves entering the eye, and the light waves are 186,000 miles per second or 300,000 kilometers per second. So our car is 100 kilometers per hour, so it's really, really fast. So the light waves are coming already through what I call the etheric layer, which is the first layer of the auric field, and the light waves are coming, which has a lot to do with safety. Light waves are coming through the cell structures of the cornea, through the aqueous humor fluid, through the lens, through the vitreous humor to the macula. So it's almost like light waves have to go through structures and fluids to come to the entire retina and to the macula itself. And from there, the information is literally in really fast going through the brain, through the thalamus, which is the overall coordination for brainstem and spinal cord, and it goes through the visual radiation into the lower visual cortex, which are synapses found within the lower region of the visual cortex, which is roughly above the neck area. And I like to come to the neck area and to this region in a moment. And in this higher region of the visual cortex, I was saying just before in the previous interview with you, that in the higher region of the visual cortex, I discovered there is a overall coordination, an energetic overall coordination, which coordinates the three brain layers and the physiology of the eye. And I think we are all born with the potential of coordination, yet although 7 billion people, but there seem to be somehow an aspect in us which we are, where we are not really recognizing our coordination, or we are stopping ourselves to really use the potential.
Would you say in a way that's analogous to the way that we are not realizing our potential when we tense our necks and the quality of our movement through space is compromised? Or does it have a different, is there more to it than that?
No, I think it's that. I think we have got the potential, we have got the synapses, but we are not using it, just like we are not using the full potential of our arm movements or our lower back, for example. Mm-hmm. And the same thing relates to the brain itself too. That we may be, I mean, as Einstein was saying, that we may use only 10% of our brain. So mm-hmm. I guess if we are using only 1% more of our brain, our life would look already so totally different. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And here I promote, or what I discovered through my Alexander applied to vision work, that I discovered there lies an extraordinary potential for synapse function within the higher region of the visual cortex, which, from my understanding, has got the direct potential of coordinating our function of brain, function of fluid and structures of the eye, and the physical body in a lengthening, widening, in a efficient way at the same time.
And is that, in your experience and in your view, a complement to, Alexander's primary control, where he was talking about the head-neck relationship? Do you see it as a complement to that, or something that, in a sense, almost supersedes that?
I think Alexander was really a genius in his time to discover principles which are applicable in every moment in life. I think at that time, over 100 years ago, the brain was not really on the agenda, so to speak. Yes, the brain mm-hmm. wasn't really part of what we talked about it. And only in the last 15 years or so, or 20 years with technology, suddenly the researchers find out so much more about the brain, and everybody talks about the brain. So the eye in itself could not see. The eye without the brain can't do very much. So it's actually the brain, the hard drive in the brain itself, which will allow that the physiology of the eye can function. And I like to come to a point that I'm not habitually using my brain, my eye, or my body, but that I can come out of consciousness and can instruct my brain and my fluid and structures in such a way that light waves can come unhindered through the fluid and structures of the eye to stimulate the lower visual cortex with clear-sightedness. So clear-sightedness would be a byproduct out of coordination. And what we usually tend to do is no coordination, and we end gain to see the letters in a book or to see the far distant tree without using an overall mechanism which allows brain, eye, body to coordinate in such a way that light waves can come unhindered into the eye, into the brain, to stimulate clear-sightedness.
So to just elaborate on what you said, or put a little different spin on it, Alexander, of course, was totally aware of mind-body connections.
Yes.
In fact, his take on that was that mind and body are just two aspects of the same thing. But as you say, back in the 1890s, when he was developing his work, there was no mapping of the brain of the kind that we have today. I'm guessing it was pretty primitive, whatever it was. And
yes.
Now we know an awful lot more about the internal mapping of the brain. So could it, of the brain itself,
yes.
the physical organism of the brain.
Yes.
So would it be a fair description of your work to say that you're basically applying Alexander principles,
yes.
to how our brain functions, which
exactly
is not
that.
Something that Alexander would have probably
thought about,
given the state of knowledge when he was alive.
I think Alexander just did not think yet about this.
But he did know. One thing Alexander did know for sure is that people were going to make a lot of important discoveries after he died. He was really clear about that he never, ever set himself out as saying, this is it. And he used phrases like, I hope someday my work will be seen as a signpost for those who follow in my footsteps, that sort of thing. Yeah,
now,
interesting.
If I think about the brain and the evolution of the brain, I think we have got, in my jargon, so to speak, we have got three brain layers, and it makes this easier for the listeners to understand. The first brain layer would be the thalamus and the hypothalamus, which would be the coordination of brainstem and spinal cord, like a reptilian brain. And out of this reptilian brain, the first layer through the optic nerve developed, which I think developed the inner layer of the eye. There was there was almost like the eye, which as a reptile, we had to see the peripheral vision to see if somebody gobbles me or who can I eat? Who will eat me? Who can I eat? There was a real basic part of the eye and basic brain. Now, when the next brain developed, it's a limbic brain, which wraps around the thalamus and the brain stem, which became the emotional and the social and emotional brain, where I think where all our sensory impulses are going in, hearing and smell and touch and the kinesthesia, but as well where our mental thoughts are going through, where our short-term memories, like memories for the last 100 years, are going through, and long-term memories like cell memories, DNA memories, our memories from our last 7 generations, and those things. And mm-hmm. and I think the overall coordination at that time with this second brain was something about feeling and sensing. Mm-hmm. And when we develop then our latest brain, our neocortex brain, then where our conscious thinking happens in nowadays, I think each time, each latest brain had an overall coordination. When we had no neocortex, only the reptilian and the limbic brain, then the limbic brain had the overall coordination. And it's almost like nowadays we are transiting from this reptilian and limbic brain to our neocortex with the overall coordination, which somehow seemed to be the intent for seeing, the intent for vision. Now, if we, and I'm not saying we do at the moment, but if we would be growing a fourth brain layer, then I think the overall coordination would need to be at the end of the fourth layer. Mm-hmm. And then vision would not be the overall coordination. And I think where we are headed, where we are at the moment worldwide, is transiting out of this doing mode from the limbic brain, our emotional and reacting to what arises there, by out of the intent for presence, which my slant of inhibition, of stopping interfering what naturally arises, and out of this presence staying with the intensity as well with the emotional intensity which rises, and knowing we don't die from this emotional intensity, mm-hmm. at least not now, maybe right. in the past we did, but not now. Mm-hmm. And then it transforms into essences which we are connecting with our overall coordination, which we have got at this time in our brain's evolution.
Well, you know, it's interesting, getting back to Alexander for a second.
Yes.
The title of his first book, written yes. around in the early 20th century, Man's Supreme Inheritance.
Yes.
And I think most, I assume that most Alexander teachers would see that as our ability to, often untapped, but our ability to consciously bring about changes in our yes. patterns of behavior. Yes. And it sounds a bit to me like that's that third layer, right?
Yes.
That is sort of designed, in a sense, to be in charge of the whole system.
Yes. And I think Alexander, maybe he didn't refer to this, but I think he came very much from that position, so from that thinking, with this vision in mind.
Mm-hmm.
And right. maybe nowadays, with more brain research, we can maybe explain this a little bit more.
Well, it is interesting. This is kind of a little off topic, but I think it's intriguing that in the last, certainly the last 10 years, last 10 to 20 years, a lot of research in the field of neuroscience
yes.
has seemed to be quite congruent with certain Alexander technique ideas. And recently, actually, there have been some pretty interesting scientific studies conducted in the UK measuring things like postural tone and gait and things of that kind,
yes.
where for the first time you have, in studying it, the effects of Alexander lessons on those things, that have shown that the Alexander technique can directly affect those phenomena. It's not about getting people's impressions of what's going on. It's actual very precise measurements of what's going on. And it's just, I mean, I think there's a whole series more experiments planned by the same investigator. And I believe there are other people who are starting to work in that field. But it does a little bit tie in with what you're talking about. That is, Alexander's understanding, even though he didn't have the brain mapped,
yes.
he couldn't have had it mapped, but his basic understanding is relevant for that mapping. Our use of that mapping, let's say.
Exactly, exactly. Mm-hmm. So it's really, really helpful what he discovered at that time and applying it. I mean, he was a very practical person, yes, of applying. I mean, it's really great to have the understanding of the brain, but it really takes another aspect, and that's where Alexander's work is so important, of having a mindfulness practice, which I'm able not only in a formal way, but in an informal way, to apply this in my day-to-day activities, so that really more synapses in my brain, and in such a way freedom within the physiology of eyes and the musculature, but the physiology of the entire body can be really practiced in activities like eating and driving mm-hmm. and reading, in computer work, so that our brain synapses into our old age can really function more and more efficiently.
And we're kind of running out of time, Peter, but I just can't resist mentioning something we talked about, which is Wilhelm Reich, who is
Yes.
a was a originally, I believe, a follower of Freud, but broke with Freud,
Yes.
and was a very controversial, fascinating, interesting guy. And there still are remnants of what's called Reichian therapy out there.
Yes.
And Reich, I was very struck when reading some of his work. He used some sort of hands-on work to enhance the psychotherapy he was doing. And
Yeah.
he, at one point, says that the what he called the ocular block, which really refers to that segment of our bodies that includes the eyes, he said that was the toughest one to change. That was the last to go. And I'm wondering, just in view of our conversation just now, whether, of course, Reich died quite a few years ago, that in part that was because the brain had not been mapped particularly well at that point. And he didn't really have the tools to deal with that.
Well, thank you very much to mention this. Yes, I think if we are lingering in our reptilian and the limbic brain by reacting with over and under focusing, then it's almost like the ocular block keeps in there. The amygdala, our eons of experience, which have never been really freed, it keeps stuck there. And for me, the emotional aspect and letting emotions and feelings rise is really a fundamental aspect of this eye-body vision work. Because out of the intent for presence, we are able, I'm able, I call them stories and no stories, things I experience in over and under focusing eons back, they are still held within this amygdala. And fundamentally, I think there is no fundamental change. And I think out of consciousness of having an application of presence, which is Alexander's notion of inhibition, of stopping interfering what rises, I can stay with the needing to stay with the intensity, even sometimes there's more intensity, sometimes less intensity. And out of staying with the intensity, there is a transformation of the amygdala contents, and this rises to the upper visual cortex, and this becomes my fodder. This becomes the food for visualizing out of consciousness, which is literally one brain further up. And from there, I discovered there is a blueprint. Let's say there's a blueprint between the brain layers and the physiology of the eye, and we would like to connect out of direction with our blueprint of the eyes. And then we are really undoing in a non-doing way, we are really undoing our reptilian and our limbic stronghold there. And I think then we are really undoing the ocular block simultaneously. Yet we need direction to give it oomph, to give it schmackes, to give it more real power.
So I guess, I mean, you could
The
argue
mojo lies there.
you could argue that unless the ocular block is released, we as humans are not really getting our full
Potential.
potential, our full what's the title of Alexander's book? It escapes me. I can't even think of it. The title of his first book, Our Supreme Inheritance,
Patterns,
is being
yes.
compromised. Well, I
Yes.
think this would be a great place to bring this conversation to an end.
Thank you very much, Rick.
Obviously, we've been talking about some pretty interesting stuff that may not be totally familiar to everyone who's listening, and I would commend you to visit Peter's website. We'll put a link to that site, and to get a copy of his book, which explains a lot of this stuff. But my guest today has been Peter Grunewald, who teaches workshops around the world and also lives in Auckland, New Zealand. Peter, thanks so much for being on the show.
Thank you very much, Robert.